This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Some of the brightest students from across the U.S. met just outside Washington, D.C. last month for the finals of the National History Day contest, and there was a rare two-time winner.
I legitimately adore this competition so much, and so I am willing to do it as many years as I can.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to that exceptional student and learn all about National History Day. We'll also get an update on what some congressional Democrats are doing in the wake of the Supreme Court's Janus decision on public sector unions. And if you don't want to fall on your face, then spend an academic minute with us out on the dance floor. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. National History Day is a year-long academic program that helps students in grades 6 through 12 build skills in historical research, interpretation, and creative expression. The program culminates in a series of contests at the local and affiliate levels and an annual national competition in College Park, Maryland, every June. Gary Pettit is the Director of Communications for National History Day.
We are a nonprofit based in College Park, Maryland. We have been running the National History Day contest since 1974 when it was started at Case Western Reserve University in Ohio, started by Dr. Van Tassel, one of the history professors there, who saw the power of project-based learning in things like science fair and said, hey, I want to do that for history. So he started this contest, and it slowly grew from regional Ohio contests into a national contest and now even an international contest. So we have 57 affiliates that participate annually, all 50 states, Washington, D.C., Guam, Puerto Rico, American Samoa, and a couple international schools in China, Korea, and the rest of Southeast Asia. So more than 500,000 students participate in this contest now, and less than 1% make it to the national contest, which is what Max ended up winning at, was the national contest.
I'll interrupt here for a second. Max is Max Mateer, a student at Pensacola High School in Pensacola, Florida, who'll be going into his sophomore year in the fall. We'll be talking to him and hear some of his winning entry in just a few minutes. But first, I wanted to know how students around the country get involved in the program.
Like most contests, you have your local level. So you start at the school, you start in the classroom, and there's one of, and you can do any one of five categories. There's paper, performances, websites, documentaries, exhibits. And then there's also a group or individual component for four of those. You cannot write a group paper, but the other ones you could do a group or individual. So when we break it down into talking about what category somebody is participating in, we would say something like junior individual performance or senior individual performance or senior group website. And Max was competing in the senior individual performance category. And incidentally, he actually won the junior individual performance category last year as well.
So you can have repeat winners.
Yes, it's rare. It is very rare, but you can have it.
What do students get for winning this?
So the first place students get a prize sponsored by the National Endowment for the Humanities, one of our major sponsors, and that is worth $1,000. So they get $1,000 and the title NEH Scholar.
Where do some of these students end up going? I mean, you get some, obviously, some pretty good students there. Where do they end up going from this? What do they do with their prize?
Well, some of them, they immediately start working on the next year. You know, they finish up this year's project and they're done with it. Other ones take it on and they do amazing things with it. We've had students in the past who have taken their projects on to get published in journals, to display them at conferences. Some who even, you know, draw back on them when they go to college and go, hey, I did a project on this when I was in, you know, high school or middle school. I can use that research for this college project or for a paper or for something else.
All right, and how do schools get involved?
Schools get involved typically by contacting their affiliate coordinator, and the affiliate is what we also call the states. So, you know, every state is an affiliate, and every state has a coordinator. And teachers would contact them and say, I would like to get involved, and they'll connect them with, here's your local contest, here's how you would enter in it. And the other thing is that, I mean, on our website, nhd.org, is instructions for how to kind of get involved and start creating a project, because the initial way that you get involved is just creating a project for submission to the contest.
So to get to the finals and to win the finals, how many times did Max have to do that presentation?
Let's see. If he was in Florida, he would have had to do it at the school level, and then they do counties. Not every state does counties, but Florida does the counties. So he would have had to do it at the county level, and then he would have had to perform at the state level, and then he would have had to perform it at the national level. And performances are a bit of an anomaly because you have to perform it twice at some levels. So you do the first round, and then if you're good enough in the first round, you make it to the final round. So then you have to perform it twice, where if you did an exhibit or something, you would just set your exhibit up and the judges would look at it. And the second round, they would look at it again, but you wouldn't have to present it. So he had to perform it, two, four, six, eight times maybe?
So he's probably good at it by now. I could ask him to do it next week. He could probably recite it.
Oh, I bet he will. I bet he will if you ask him.
So when does this start up next time?
So the next season has started. Traditionally, we start it right when the award ceremony ends. So every year is a theme, and we try to make these themes broad enough that students can choose just about any topic that would interest them, but still be able to apply it to the theme. So last year, 2018, the theme was conflict and compromise in history, and the 2019 theme is triumph and tragedy in history. I think one of the things that makes this so attractive and powerful for learning, for such a learning tool, is the aspect that the students get to choose their own topic. And in Max's case, he chose President Polk, which you can ask him when he's there, but his parents were a little apprehensive about doing a performance on Polk because they said, well, is that really going to be the most interesting and engaging topic? Are you going to be able to engage your audience with that? And Max was all about it, and that's kind of the great thing about this program is the students get to choose what they want to research. And by doing that, it helps invest them to put the time and energy necessary in to do research that is far beyond what a typical middle and high school student does.
Well, if you can make President Polk interesting, you deserve a prize.
Yeah, exactly. And he clearly did.
That's great. How long are these presentations?
The performances have to be under 10 minutes. That's one of the rules is it's got to be under 10 minutes.
And are there any kind of limitations on any of the other?
Documentaries, again, you have to be under 10 minutes. Papers, there's a word limit. And exhibits, there's a word limit on that as well.
Right.
And the website has a word limit, too.
And I guess that brings us to Max Mateer. Before we get to my talk with him, let's listen to a little of his winning performance.
Oh, no, that's not for me. That's my boss.
Uncle James, President Polk. Aunt Sarah thought, guess you know, when the president enters the room, and she found this music. Perchance it'll catch on. Well, Uncle James doesn't exactly command presidential attention. He doesn't even like parties. Too much palaver. He'd much rather be here with me in the Red Room. Ah, Joseph Knox Walker, private secretary of the president. He says he's the hardest working man in this country, and I can confirm that. He doesn't think a president should take a vacation, which means his private secretary doesn't either. Uncle James thinks the president should complete all of his campaign promises in one term.
My name is Max Mateer. I'm going into my sophomore year at Pensacola High.
Well, first of all, what got you so interested in history?
Well, I originally started the History Fair competition is actually what got me into history itself. And how I started that was it was a part of the gifted class that I was in. There's a class at the middle school I went to, Gulfbreeze Middle, for 6th, 7th, and 8th graders, and a part of the required curriculum was to participate in the National History Day competition. And so I started out in my 6th grade year. I made it to Nationals with that one, but unfortunately was not lucky enough to move on to runoffs, and then came back with a passion for 7th grade, still did not do anything, and then came back with an even further passion for my 8th grade year, where I was lucky enough to win, and then came back this next year.
What are your subjects? Have you been the same subject all the time, or you're just poking around?
I mainly poke around with my obsession of history. I'm just a history buff in general, so I really you could throw anything in front of me and I'd enjoy it. As of right now, I'm really into like the World War I kind of era, but I've done projects on the Cold War, on more modern third world country kind of concepts. And obviously Polk, so mid-1800s kind of stuff. I did one on the Cuban Missile Crisis last year. That was fun.
And you won for that one, right?
Yes, sir.
Tell me about that. What did you actually do for the Cuban Missile Crisis?
So my project last year, the theme that year was Taking a Stand in History. So I talked about a man named Vasily Arkhipov, who was a Soviet submarine fleet commander who refused to fire a nuclear torpedo with the strength of the Hiroshima bomb. And because of that, on that single day, he actually allowed Kennedy and Khrushchev to negotiate the next day and have all the missiles be agreed to be pulled out of Cuba. And so his stand essentially opened the door for the diplomacy that Kennedy and Khrushchev are so well remembered for.
And that was a performance?
Yes, sir.
So what did you do?
Well, I have this big set and basically all manufactured to look like a submarine and something called the XCOM room. XCOM was the big committee established by President Kennedy to handle the Cuban Missile Crisis. And so I had one side where I portrayed Bobby Kennedy and then another side where I portrayed Vasily Arkhipov himself. But those are my two main body sections. My intro I actually had portrayed as Arthur Schlesinger, President Kennedy's personal historian. And my conclusion, I portray a high school student raring to go and getting into his dream college, all because of what Vasily Arkhipov did.
Did you do different voices and accents?
Yes, sir. So Arthur Schlesinger, he's a very polished, pristine man. He talks about how we're lucky to be alive, and then you got to go into Bobby Kennedy, how Jack always talks to you, and you got to, you know, whether it's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, or Friday, it just, that's how he talks. But Vasily Arkhipov, it's very rigid. He's a strong man. And then, of course, the student is just portrayed by me with my regular accent to really drive home that youth feel.
And talk about the project you did this year, which when I heard who you went after, I was going, really? That? He's interesting.
Well, the theme this year was conflict and compromise in history. And I originally discovered James K. Polk, our 11th president, through an American history class taught by the same teacher who was my gifted teacher. So obviously it was very close to home at that point. And basically I originally got on the topic because she comes in and I ask her about how there's only one paragraph dedicated to him, but something seems off about him. Like there's more to it, but it doesn't talk about it. She starts listing on his fingers all of his campaign promises and how he did it all in one term. I had this chance to see a president who made 4 campaign promises and accomplished every single one of them. And so from there, I delved into it and ended up developing my thesis for my project, which was by leveraging compromise to manage conflict and intentionally starting conflict to achieve compromise, James K. Polk created the iconic shape of the United States and expanded our reach from sea to shining sea.
And how did you do? What kind of a performance did you do on that one?
Very similar to my previous year's performance. We have a system. We have a formula. So I have 2 big set pieces. One was a Paul Morphy room. So Paul Morphy was a chess player from the mid-1800s during Polk's time. And so a core motif of my performance, I'm paralleling all of Polk's calculations to chess and how he's advancing his rook, taking the queen, stuff like that. And so I have Paul Morphy deliver the introduction, and then he sets the stage, lays the historical context, all that stuff. And then I have the other side of my set, which is the White House Red Room, a room actually established by Polk in the White House. And the character for that one is Knox Walker, who is Polk's personal secretary and nephew. And so he delivers all the nitty-gritty stuff of the Mexican-American War and the Oregon Question, stuff like that. And then finally, I come out, I unfold my set, and it's this big, actually the history classroom that I was in when I found out about Polk, and I portray an homage to my own teacher by being this energetic history teacher talking about how he only gets this one paragraph in the history book, and he deserves more credit because he did so much.
And he said he was only going to do one term, and he mm-hmm. got out of office, and then a couple months later died.
Mm-hmm. That's actually a... He died of cholera, but the thing about it, a lot of historians believe that he worked himself so hard that the exhaustion kind of helped that. He actually finished all of his campaign promises with 8 months to spare. So it's fun to speculate whether or not if he had maybe metered himself out a little bit more, he might have gone on to do more, be more, and possibly achieve many more incredible things in his future.
Well, speaking of going on, what about you? Are you going to do this again next year?
Yes, sir. I legitimately adore this competition. so much. And so I am willing to do it as many years as I can. I'm hoping to do it for the next 3 years of high school. I might take 1 year as a break just to focus on college and stuff like that. But I'm really excited for next year because the theme is triumph and tragedy. And, of course, my family treating history fair like a religion, we already have idea after idea going in our minds, the cogs turning, wheels spinning.
And what about the future for you? What happens when you get out of high school?
Well, surprisingly enough, as much as I adore history, I am not interested in pursuing it as a field of study. It will definitely be something that if I have elective hours, I'll take credit. I'll take classes on it. But I'm interested in pursuing mechanical engineering and creative writing. And my dream school is MIT because they're up there as one of the top schools for mechanical engineering. And they actually have a program where you can joint major in something, STEM, so science, technology, engineering, and math, and creative. So I want to do a joint degree of mechanical engineering and creative writing.
All right. The biggest question. Your parents let you keep the money?
Most of it goes to college funds, all that stuff. But they let me use a little bit of it for a little bit of spending. But
all right. Well, I wouldn't bet against you. Well done.
Thank you very much, sir.
And again, the topic for next year's National History Day contest is Triumph and Tragedy in History. We'll check back next year and let you know how Max does. Still to come, some lawmakers are introducing legislation to help teachers' unions after the Supreme Court's ruling in the Janus case. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, any place. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. A day after the Supreme Court ruled against public sector unions in the so-called Janus decision, congressional Democrats gathered in Washington to introduce a measure in response to the court's 5-4 ruling. The Best of Our Knowledge's Dave Lucas reports.
The High Court's so-called Janus ruling found it unconstitutional for unions to charge agency fees to employees who aren't members but benefit from collective bargaining. Democratic Senator Mazie Hirono of Hawaii and Democratic Congressman Matt Cartwright of Pennsylvania introduced the Public Service Freedom to Negotiate Act to ensure that public sector employees across the country are able to form and join a union and engage in collective bargaining with employers. Senator Hirono.
It sets federal minimum standard that every state in this country must meet to provide these basic rights to our public employees. And these standards include the right of employees to organize and form a union. These are not normal times. We all need to come together to fight back against this all-out assault on working people.
While Janus versus Ask Me plaintiff Mark Janus's lawyers tell Politico their next step is to ensure the ruling is implemented, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer vows Democrats will fight hard to undo the Janus decision.
When it comes to the lives of middle-class Americans and those struggling to get there, and the Janus decision is a gut punch to working people across America. It's a gut punch to income equality. It's a gut punch to 50 years of progress. It's a despicable decision. And the court reached out to overturn 40 years of precedent on a flimsy, almost made-up First Amendment justification to meet their ideological needs.
Schumer, a New York Democrat, says the greatest problem in America is that middle-class incomes are not keeping up with the cost of living.
And the golden age of America was when America was unionized. And middle-class incomes and pensions and health care advanced. But now the hard right wants to take it away. They know they could never pass this stuff, even in a conservative House and Senate. And so they use the one elected body, the one non-elected body, the Supreme Court.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi characterized the Supreme Court as Supreme Corp and handmaidens of corporate America. Schumer and his fellow Democrats are also focusing on the High Court's future makeup following conservative Justice Anthony Kennedy's resignation at the end of July.
What happened in the Supreme Court shows why we must not have another hard-right Supreme Court nominee who will not follow precedent and put their own ideological stamp on issue after issue. Janus illustrates that and should be a clarion call to working people to make sure that another nominee who will do that, and you can be certain that anyone who made that list of 25 culled by the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation will move to remove even more workers' rights. We will fight it all the way.
Despite the Democrats' concerns, unions are not exactly on their deathbeds yet. Recent Pew and Gallup polls show that 60% of the public has a favorable view of unions, and that number rises to 75% among millennials. Reporting for the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Dave Lucas.
If you want to prevent falls when you get older, well, it's time to get up and dance. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Dancing isn't just for the young. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Lisa Stiegel, assistant professor of biology at Hamline University, reports the elderly also see a benefit.
Could getting up and moving to the music decrease the risk of falling in the elderly? My colleague Kathy Thompson and I designed a study to find out, and our findings are promising. Once a week for 9 weeks, seniors aged 60 to 80 years old participated in an hour of music and movement training called Dalcroze Eurythmics. Led by a certified instructor who played improvised music on a piano, the seniors walked in time with the music, changed directions, and handled and passed objects rhythmically. They moved individually, with a partner, and in small groups to increase social interaction. Our research team, made up of faculty and students from the exercise science, music, and public health programs, tested the participants' walking ability before and after the intervention and found that gait speed, or walking speed, significantly improved. This held true even when participants were asked to walk and perform another task at the same time, called dual tasking. This latter finding is important because most falls occur while walking, especially when performing other tasks. Why did this intervention improve dual-task walking by 20%? We hypothesize that the improvement was due to the multi-component movement training unique to Dalcroze Eurythmics. Stepping to the beat of the music while carrying a ball and passing that ball to another person in time to the music requires awareness, attention, balance, and coordination. These are the same skills needed when navigating the home, neighborhood, or the grocery store. This intervention is easy to implement in places like senior living and community centers. It requires musical expertise and training in Dalcroze Eurythmics, but virtually no equipment other than a piano or keyboard and space to move around. Our hope is that more senior programs will offer this type of intervention as an engaging and effective way to reduce fall risk in the elderly.
That was Lisa Stiegel of Hamline University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.